shout out. He's already given handles. He's given social media handles. Is that still your social media handle?
Yeah.
Okay, you can find Rick Instagram at Trick Wheeler. It's fantastic. More importantly, you can find Rick and his business entity at
Lion and Lamb Coffee.
That's right, folks. Instagram. That's our conversation today is with the one and only founder. Well, not one and only. I mean, he's got a partner. He's got a business partner and his soon-to-be wife, Rosie.
Wifey.
She's out there. She's not with us, but she's out there somewhere. Yeah. So Rick and Rosie, you guys are really the partners, business founders of Lion and Lamb Coffee. They're roasters, roasters with a cause. And as a church community, we thought it'd be so timely as we are about to embark on a new journey and a new endeavor with Lion and Lamb to have Rick on here and just start from the very beginning and share his story, his personal story, as well as some of his kind of business story, which I think is compelling and inspirational for many of you listeners out there. Maybe you're in the business space or organizational space. I've learned a lot sitting with Rick, hearing about kind of the ethos and the heart and even the philosophy behind his business, behind coffee, what you can do with coffee. And so we're going to get into that at the end. But Rick, tell us about yourself, man. Church, because that's just selfish. Tell us about your personal trajectory with coffee, your relationship with coffee.
Well, I started probably back in 2010, working at a shop in Tustin. My friend Nick, who was working there, I'm not going to name the shop, but we started working there as baristas. And I just fell in love with it. Yeah. Up until that point, my life's goal was to be a chef.
No way.
And I'm totally into cooking and all that. And I feel like coffee is like kind of a subsection of mm-hmm. the culinary arts mm-hmm. that some people don't know about. Mm-hmm. So it's like really cool to experiment. And we both fell in love with that. And, we worked there for 2 years before starting another venture.
How old were you then when you started the venture?
22.
That's amazing. So cool.
Yeah. So it's Nick, who's my best bud, and his mom. We were both working at this one shop, and she's like, "Oh, I want to start a shop. Do you guys kind of want to run it? And I'll put up the dough, and we'll get some sweat equity out of it." And we were like, "Yeah." And so that was a monumental feat. Mm-hmm. Can't believe it even became anything. Mm-hmm. But it did. But yeah, definitely learned a lot. And it was super challenging, but also rewarding. And we can get into all those things.
Well, give me a moment. Was there a moment, a valley or a pit moment where you just I can picture, I worked in the restaurant biz. I was not in an ownership or management stake like you were. I was just a hireling, just a meager server. But I can just picture someone breaking down, behind the bar or on the restaurant floor, on your knees, just this is
the
moment.
Yeah, that was me. I think honestly, it was just, we're all new, mm-hmm. and we all, three of us, had different ideas of what we wanted the space to be. Mm-hmm. And that was the hardest part. And that was the main reason why I left, mm-hmm. In the beginning, just because there are just so many different visions. And I was kind of the odd man out. So right. I kind of made the call to be I kind of want to keep the friendship going, rather than the business. And I kind of wanted to do my own thing too. But I'm glad that happened. And, Nick and I are still really good friends but we both learned a lot, and he learned a lot with me leaving, and mm-hmm. I learned a lot, while I was there and leaving too.
You guys are both friends today, which is a huge testament to that, just how it must have gone down even in the decision point. And obviously now post living in that post partnership realm, the fact that you guys are still bros says a lot about mm-hmm. both of you. Mm-hmm. You just said that you had so many learnings upon learnings upon learnings. What was one of those learnings? It could be an organizational one, a business one, just a coffee one. What was one of the biggest learnings? Relationship one?
I think, the list is endless. I think as a new business owner, probably to give yourself some like leniency and grace, mm-hmm. and not, it's easy not to say like stress out about, I still struggle with wanting to like be perfect in, you know, what I produce. Mm-hmm. And I've kind of been on this road of like, you know, back then it was like, I'm not going to put something out unless it's done and like sealed, mm-hmm. and I just can hand it to the world and it's like ready to go.
Right.
I think there's a word for that. But now, and what I did learn, and for sure, you know, that business was a part of that, and kind of Nick was a proponent of this, whether he was conscious about it or not, which was just like, you kind of just go and do, and if you mess up, like, it's not a big deal.
Yeah.
I think he takes it to the extreme. But yeah, you know, I think people are more receptive of your, as a business or as a person, of like, you know, you're not perfect, and you know, if you're out of, you know, a certain ingredient that day or whatever, like, hey, I'm really sorry, you know, here's a free drink or whatever, next time we'll, you know, we're new, we're trying our best, and
right.
and people are pretty receptive to that, and if they're not, then they're just not,
yeah, not an ideal customer to be with.
Yeah, and so for sure that I think that translates to life too, just, you know, give yourself a little grace.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, for relationship stuff, I think it's just hard. If you're planning to go into business with friends, I think like people worry about like Rosie and I, mm-hmm. you know, 'cause we're friends, I guess, but we're also, going to be husband and wife and stuff, you know, I'm cautioning, you know, friends and business stuff, but what makes it different is that Rosie and I have like the same heart, yeah. and the same vision for mm-hmm. what we want, mm-hmm. really. And at the end of the day, like, I'm comfortable with Rosie, like, making a call, 'cause I trust her 100%, and the other way around. And before, it was kind of like, we went into it like we were just always going to butt, you know, heads, because mm-hmm. it was always like a give and take compromise kind of a deal. And that can work. But it's just gonna be really hard.
Yeah.
So I know that I just like said, I'm going to take months off from the business. Rosie's got it, and I can come back and it'll be like the same as how we dreamed it up, and, totally. And vice versa. So
totally.
If you're looking
it's a baby.
For,
it's a child.
Yeah. If you're looking, yeah, exactly. If you're looking for like a partner, then try to have that. And yeah,
that's awesome. I there's so much there. Give yourself grace, act fast in decision-making. Owners, managers, leaders have to have a certain degree of that. I know you probably hear me more from the pulpit saying pray and exercise caution or wisdom or whatever. I just listened to a great, great Christian leader on a podcast the other day say, you know, managers or owners or leaders, whoever you are, need to be problem solvers. They need to be the master problem solvers too.
Mm-hmm.
And one of his subpoints was decisions, like speed in decisions. You got to make them, you know, they even hire to that. They hire people that will make them. Then we'll belabor it forever, succumb to that perfectionism and not act at all. They really value that. So
yeah,
so
I think
yourself grace.
I think that element is necessary, but again, back to like me and Rosie were both like, so I think having an understanding of yourself too is important for all aspects of life. But for me, and this is definitely something I learned at True Brew of like, which is the coffee shop name, which is, you know, kind of know your role and don't, mm-hmm. you know, be open to challenges and learning new things. But if you don't know yourself, then go out there and, you know, learn. So what I learned is that, you know, I can do all these things. I can be a manager. I can be, you know, all these roles. But really my role of what I love to do and what I think is my best role is like being very zoomed out
mm-hmm.
on everything and, mm-hmm. and making like, you know, a 5-step plan for whatever it is and saying, okay, well in 5 years, this is where we're going to be at. And really, I think that's a critical aspect to it. And then the other aspect is have like a kind of a go-getter doer, like, you know, you can give them a task or whatever and it's going to get done. And, kind of like an on the ground person.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, yeah, it works out for me and Rosie that way.
I was just going to say that's of the third learning you shared there, which is a relational one. I completely affirm that in you and Rosie. You seem different enough, common enough, in your lanes distinctively enough that it really, really works. I've had friends and couples where they're like, yeah, we're husband and wife. We're going into business. And I thought, man, that might be fraught with some challenges. I can tell you this, bro to bro, even though we're live on air, never thought about that, like, for even 2 seconds of the two of you. It's for sure. And I think it comes from, and that's why you guys are so primed for marriage too. I would just bless you in saying your emotional intimacy, which is like that trust, that foundation, that common vision, that where we're going, is very strong. It's a gift from God probably that he's given you guys that will,
be successful. That like plays into the whole thing. Long story, I don't know if we'll get in through it all, maybe. Let's be a 2 hour.
The coffee, you had a couple more stops before Lion and Lamb, obviously.
Well, I guess to back up and kind of show the journey and the progression of all this and how it happened, and kind of have to jump back and forth, and it might get confusing, but at the end it's gonna make a lot of sense. So I've always like been drawn to business and being like an entrepreneur. I've always had like weird jobs that like made me money or whatever. And I never wanted to like be a normal person. but I was also really drawn to like philanthropy, and I had this, I guess you can call over the top positivity, I guess, which most people think's crazy, but I just see problems that you would think are like, they're just there and there's nothing you could do about it. Mm-hmm. And, or, you know, challenging the status quo.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm trying to do with the business. But I feel like the journey that I was put on to be here, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for that. Mm-hmm. And that was like the bumpiest road of like all time. And it really started, you know, when I like left high school. I went to a Christian high school, and I was like a normal 18-year-old Christian. Mm-hmm. And, you know, once I left school, it was kind of like, all right, well, there's no really room for God in my life, because I'm the boss.
Yeah.
And if I'm going to do something, then, you know, it's going to be on me. And I'm going to put it all on my back. And so I did that, and I lost that sense of challenging, you know, what I used to really revel in of, you know, being, seeing things and just, you know, there was nothing I thought that couldn't happen, or, you know, anyone if they put their mind to it. And I stopped caring about that. I really more focused on like the world and what, you know, it expected of me. I, you know, chose to go to college for a brief period. And really, if I chose what I really wanted to do down in my heart, it would have been just to like stay at home and read and, you know, do research on things I was passionate about. But I chose to go to school because that's kind of what was expected. And I valued what people would think if I, you know, went to a JC or something.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like the first kind of moment on this path that I went on, of thinking my plan was like the best plan, and I'm, you know, going to end up on this path of, you know, great success and all this stuff because of what I'm doing. And,
right.
And really that just kind of led me to a place of despair. So once, you know, I came back from school, and I started working at the coffee shop. And then we started True Brew, and I left there, and I went to another coffee shop, and I learned a bunch about coffee. I worked at Portola for like 2 years, and it was awesome. I learned so much about coffee, and I loved it, and it was, you know, one of the best work experiences of my life. But once I hit like 24, 25, I was kind of like, you know what, like, I can't do this for the rest of my life. It's kind of like a dead end, you know, and that world pressure was kind of on me. And I was like, you know, I had a girlfriend at the time. I was like, I got to impress her parents. I got to make a lot of money. I got to do all this stuff.
Right.
And otherwise, if it was just me, like, I would have kept doing what I loved. And so, yeah, I quit there, and I started to work in the mortgage industry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 12-hour days, going on Saturdays, maybe even Sundays.
Right.
And it was all right, but it was like I hated working. I was not passionate about it at all. Like I'd rather do like anything than that. And I was there for like a year and a half. I made good money. Mm-hmm. Couldn't spend any of it because I didn't have any time. I like never saw my girlfriend at the time. And yeah, it was hard. Definitely a learning experience there, for sure.
Let me interject really quick.
Yeah.
Did the mortgage office have a coffee shop or a coffee kitchen?
No, it was like downstairs. You had to, well, we were on the 8th floor, okay. And we had to go down. It was just like this little nothing.
Yeah.
But from that point in my life, I was like, I'm done with coffee. I really said like, I'm never going back to coffee because it's just like, I felt like at that time I had like wasted my life.
Wow.
Which is sad. And so, yeah, I said, you know what? No more. I need to be a big boy, mm-hmm. and, you know, make that cheese and everyone's going to respect me and, you know, really see how powerful I am. And I was totally, I wasn't like an atheist at this time, but, you know, I was definitely like, it doesn't, whatever, God, like, I don't need your help.
Right.
So, yeah, I was there for like a year and a half-ish. And then I was like, you know what? I'm done with this. I'm going to go out and be a professional poker player.
Are you serious?
True story.
I had no idea.
Yeah. I really love poker. It's like the perfect balance of like risk and, but it's a lot more skill than people think.
Oh, gosh.
And I've been in love with it since I was like 12 and I always wanted to do it.
That's crazy.
And right? I ended up, you know, playing on the weekends a lot and I was making just as much or more money on that one weekend than when I would going into work. And so I was like, you know what? I'm just going to risk it. Like I have money in the bank. My rent's like cheap. I'm going to go for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I did. And it was awesome. I absolutely loved it. It was the best experience of my life. I had total freedom to do whatever I wanted. If I wanted to go make, you know, $500, $1,000 that day, it was a done deal. My food would be paid for by the casino. I'd drive there. I'd listen to an audiobook. I was reading more than I ever did. I would have great conversations with the guys at the table.
Uh-huh.
And I made a lot of money.
I have no idea.
Yeah. And that was for like a year and a half. Just under a year and a half. And the big question's like, all right, well, what happened? And this is the point where my life like totally started to change. And it's like super hard to get into. It's hard to be emotional on a podcast because everyone's like, hello, is this on?
Great.
But basically, you know, everything's like going awesome. And I started to get some anxiety like in my life for like reasons that I cannot even imagine because my life's awesome. I'm doing exactly what I want. I have it all. I have the dream. Like it was my dream. I'm living my dream. It's not like I took a chance and I went broke or whatever.
Yeah.
And so I started having anxiety, getting panic attacks, all this stuff.
Yeah.
And I just stopped playing. I started staying home more. And it just totally overtook my life for reasons that I know now. But at the time was really confusing and shocking.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I ended up kind of being a hermit. I guess I was diagnosed with like agoraphobia, which is like severe anxiety. I literally did not leave my house for 6 months.
Wow.
And transitioning out of that was like super hard, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But during that time, I pretty much kind of started off that experience of obviously being very confused at the beginning, but going later and later in the months, kind of taking it upon myself of like, okay, I kind of got myself into this mess, so I need to get myself out of it. And just that same mentality of like, I'm just going to do it. I'm the boss. Listen to that. And it's hard to describe for people that really don't know this realm of mental states, but it was like, I would go out and it was like a big accomplishment for me to like drive around my block. And it was just me like 100% like, okay, we're going to do this and I'm going to, you know, make these big strides. And, it was for sure like completely hopeless, bottom of the barrel, like no hope, like at all. And I was like, I'm literally just going to be stuck in my house for the rest of my life. And, and that kind of perpetual motion that you get yourself in of like, I did this to myself. This is, it's not like, you know, I broke both my legs and like I was an Olympic skier or something and I can bounce back and do something else with my life. It was like, this is totally random. Like I'm doing this to myself. Like I'm a prisoner of my own mind. And that's kind of what I thought, but I will say that there was always like a tiny kernel of like light at the end of the tunnel. And I don't know why, but so
doing good, dude.
I don't think I consciously like made an effort to seek out God in that time, but it was in my head of like, this is totally random. Almost too random. And so I was like thinking that there had to be some explanation, because when you go back, it's like, nothing's wrong. I don't know what this is about. So I started to get that idea in my mind of this could be for some reason. And I didn't know what it was at the time. But I still, had that hope for whatever reason. And so getting out of that situation, I had a psychologist come to my house twice a week and we just worked. And I eventually got back to the coffee shop that I was working at, and I was gonna roast there, and so I did. So I did, and it was difficult, but yeah, I so the first kind of real milestone of seeing some tangible proof that this might be for a reason was that's where Rosie worked.
Man, you're doing great. I did not know the show was going to take this turn, but I'm thankful to be a part of it. What you're sharing is powerful, and I'm learning a lot just listening to you, man. I not having much personal experience with anxiety. I'm just the words. I can get us to pick back up right where you left off.
Well, but it all comes together at the end of what.
Yeah. No. How I'm picking up
where. No, no, I get it.
So Rosie was there. You came back to the coffee shop, and she was working.
Confusing. So yeah, she was there. And during that time of my major anxiety episode, I was in a relationship at the time, and that is like a whole separate story of another kink in this, but I'm not going to get into it. But yeah, that's where Rosie was. And I obviously wasn't in a place of wellness to be in a relationship. And Rosie was getting out of a relationship at the time. And but we were both just on a collision course to be together. And yeah, we worked together, and obviously we're here now. But Rosie is, and her family's obviously, they have a large Christian background, and still even at the time, I was kind of like, I don't know. I mean, definitely, like, I wasn't actively pursuing God, and
right.
I didn't want any part of that, really, and which is surprising, because if you know Rosie, you'd be like, she wouldn't take a chance, you know, for me. And it just sort of happened in an organic way of, I was open to having that in my life again, and that's kind of the catalyst that started it all. And if I didn't go through all that crap, then I would be over there, you know, in my own world, and probably, you know, miserable to some degree. We'll never know. But that was like my first moment of realizing, like, hey, there's purpose in suffering and purpose in my own suffering, and to have sort of that reward, if you will, of of Rosie and our relationship. It was like, maybe there's something to this. And if I try and trust in that, then maybe more things will happen. So I slowly started to just open my life up more and more to God. And we worked there together for about a year. And then Rosie left to go to school up north. And that was super hard. But we did it. And we always had dreams to open a coffee shop or something. And when she came back, let me back up a bit. We also had the dreams. We were like, I don't really want to do it. I didn't want to do it. Just because I had been in coffee for so long, and I had seen what it has been to be an owner, and it just wasn't worth it to me. You know, maybe way down the line or something, but I didn't want to do it. And I made plans to, or I enrolled back into school, around the time Rosie went back, and I was going to be, or I was going to get my degree in software engineering, which is like right up my alley. I'm a computer guy. Like, it's what you would, what I would think I would be if I take a test or whatever, a work test, like, you know, it's like, get work at a desk, be a software engineer, don't talk to anyone, like, solve problems, like, all this stuff. So I enrolled there. Like, I was enrolled. I picked my classes. I talked to the counselor. And this is probably like January of 18. And Rosie graduated in, oh man, my timeline's messed up. Probably. Sorry. If you keep track of my life and you know the timelines, then I might be messed up. Anyway, it doesn't matter. It was kind of like 3 months before Rosie was going to graduate, but I was like, I kind of need to get my life on track. I want to marry Rosie at that point. So again, kind of back to like the world. I need to make money, and like, I need to be successful. I need to impress her dad. I need to do all this stuff. And I was like, software engineers, they make like 100K, man, easy money. Like, I love, you know, coding and all that. It's going to be a breeze. And just like one day, I wish it was like cooler than this. I just like woke up and just like kind of went upon my day. And I just was like, you know what? I have to do something in coffee. And it wasn't like anything crazy. I didn't like wake up in the middle of the night, like gasping or something. I just, but what I did have was like just an insane peace or calm. And it was just like, yeah, I'm just going to drop out and I'm just going to do the coffee thing, whatever that is. I don't know. So originally I had always, I just wanted to roast coffee and just like sell, you know, online or to restaurants or whatever. And I don't want to deal with all the other stuff. It was going to be kind of a low bar and we'd jump over it and we would grow from there. So yeah, that was kind of the second time in my life where I kind of surrendered to the fact that I'm going to give up my plan, quote unquote, which was like to be a software engineer or whatever.
Yeah.
And take on God's plan, which was my thinking at the time, but, or was, I spent all this time in coffee and I know better than most people, like the ins and outs of the business and like really objectively what it would take to be successful. And I have Rosie who brings all the strengths that I don't have and, you know, vice versa. And just like, yeah, just like an overwhelming piece about it and just made that decision. So we were going to roast. And yeah, we started, I got a little roaster just doing it out of my house and we had some plans to go, this is like fast forwarding into the end of, 2018, my time is right. And I was going to buy a roaster. I had some money saved up. I was going to buy a roaster and we were going to put it in a family friend of Rosie's who, runs a nonprofit in Garden Grove. It's like a commercial kitchen and we were going to throw it in there and it was going to be cool. We're going to rent it out. And it was like, yes, the dream like is alive. It's going to be great. And that was like a 3-month process to ultimately at the end, long story short, just did not work out. Yeah. And that was like in December of 18. And I was pretty bummed out about that. I felt like I put a lot of work into lining it up and I felt like it was on the road that was, you know, God's plan for this. And I was like, yes, it's going to work. Like found a place, easy peasy. But yeah, it did not work out. And I was working with a guy by the name of Soren, who plays bass here at Watermark every once in a while. And I met Soren through a friend of Rosie's named Katie. And she texted us or me and said, hey, my friend Soren, you know, he would like to meet just because he's interested in coffee or something. He wants to start a shop, this and that. You know, do you want to meet him or whatever? And I was like, I guess. I don't know why. You know, that was my honest reaction. Like, why?
Right,
why?
Right.
But that would be like my, I don't know, maybe back then my normal reaction was more prone to being like, nah, like I don't want to, it's kind of sounds like a waste of time. But I did not have their action. I was like, yeah, I'll meet up with them. Sounds cool. So we met at a coffee shop and just told them kind of all my dreams, which weren't even like formulated yet. They're like totally like nothing what they are today. And we totally hit it off. We're alike in a lot of ways. And I think maybe one day in the future we'll come back and hash something up.
Oh, but mega partnership right there.
Yeah. But yeah, we totally hit it off and we kind of, he was going to help out with some marketing and sales we didn't leave there with that, but we, you know, kept in touch and texted anyway, long story short, he texted me pretty much the same week that the deal fell through with the place I was going to put the roaster. And I was at K1 Speed with Rosie and her dad. And he texted me like, hey, how's it coming along? You know, are we close to, you know, putting the roaster in or whatever? And I was like, nah, it fell through. Totally sucks. And he's like, oh, that sucks. I'll keep my ear to the ground. And like, I was like, yeah, whatever. I don't know what that means. You're going to find me a place. So about 30 minutes later, we're still at K1. He's like, hey, just had lunch with my pastor, this pastor, his name's Ben or whatever. He might have a space for you to put your roaster. And I'm like, all right, like where? In a church or something? And he gave you my number. You like text me right away.
Okay.
Yeah, total Ben persona going on. Text me right away. He's like, you want to set up a date to meet or whatever? Yeah. Which I believe was, that was on a Saturday that we were racing.
Yeah.
And we met on a Monday, which was the day before, 2 days from my birthday.
No way.
But we met, and yeah, I can remember that day, like yesterday, I was texting you, I was driving on the 91. I can remember the clouds in the sky, like the time of day.
Wow.
And yeah, at that time, Rosie and I were going to Friends Church in Orange.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I would have called myself a Christian at the time, although I was still like coming into it mm-hmm. and having that hard time
yeah.
With it.
Right.
Of like you, full acceptance.
You were, I would say, if I could be so bold, you were moving from the deconstructionist, you were in reconstruction, actually.
Yeah, for sure.
Which is remarkable because that's such a buzzword, at least in the Christian space, like deconstructionist, we throw it around all over the place. But what it assumes, but we never hear about it very often, is something that's deconstructed must be built back up, must be reconstructed.
Yeah, I felt like I went full circle twice.
Okay.
Almost, because I remember talking to you about like Catholic stuff yeah. and like, you know, real nitty gritty.
You were
pretty
wrong. You were in process. You were big time still in process when we met, which I dug. I mean, I thought it was cool.
Yeah. And yeah, so we talked, as you remember,
mm-hmm.
2 feet away from where we're sitting now.
Right.
For like 2 hours, and you're like, yeah, you put a roaster in here, like whatever you want to do. Like, and I'm like, where's the space? Like, and I thought yeah. I went into it. I thought it was going to be like a garage that you guys like had
right.
as like a side thing. And you're like, you know, just wanted to put it in there for funsies or whatever. And then you were like, yeah, here it is. And I was like, here's what? You could put it here. And I'm like, bro, this is a lobby of a church. Like, I'm not going to put a roaster in here. I mean, I didn't fully like rule it out, but I was right. like, kind of less than ideal.
Right, right.
But we talked and I don't know, man, the Spirit of God was for sure moving in there. Mm. And I feel like we had a super good talk, and I bounced even some like very, young ideas in their infancy to you and, mm-hmm. You recommended me a great book, Friction by Rosenberg or whatever, something.
Nice.
Rosenberg, and I bought that thing immediately. You're like, you got to get it. And I bought it on Amazon. I cracked it in like 3 days, and yeah. I was like, dude, that's an amazing book. And it really helped me formulate
yeah.
and shape a lot of the ideas that I had.
Whoa.
And so, yeah, we kind of left there with like a tentative plan to put the roaster in there
yeah.
and I think you might mention the coffee shop or whatever, like mm-hmm. you like brushed it
mm-hmm.
and I was like
yeah right,
I don't know,
yeah. been there, done that.
Doesn't
that
sound good.
Yeah
kind of weird. I don't know why you put it in a church lobby, like whatever.
Yeah.
And then yeah, kind of just like went home and like, I don't know, I don't even know what I did that day. Maybe just I bought the book and just like, I was like, that was kind of weird, I don't know. And then we set up another meeting, I think, and it was like me, you, and Bucky, and we talked maybe in here in the room, and then we went out there and we like walked it and
yeah.
and we talked about the phases. Maybe we put the roaster first. This is in January of 19.
Okay.
This is a long time ago.
Yeah.
And
thank God you're keeping track of the timetable.
Yeah. And we walk in, we're like, yeah, maybe roaster first, shop second, whatever. And I'm like, yeah, maybe, I don't know. And I can't remember the exact month that it like hit me that we should do the shop.
Yeah.
But it had nothing to do with you guys.
Yeah.
You kind of just put the seed there
yeah.
and like God totally watered it for sure.
Mm.
And the conclusion that I came to in the similar fashion of at the very beginning of having this like piece about it, at the very beginning of like, I'm not going to do software engineering, I got to be in coffee. I had the same piece of like, you got to do the shop.
Wow.
Because it just goes along with everything you want your brand to be, which is community and, and, you know, philanthropy and charity and making a difference. And can't do that like on behind a computer screen, just selling bags, you know, online. I mean, you can, but I'm like kind of an old school guy. Like I like having face to face stuff. Like I don't, I hate talking on the phone. I want to interact with people and see them. And yeah, we, I was just like, yeah, we're going to do it. I think probably like April or something.
Wow.
And then we were like, all right. And yeah, we still weren't even going to Watermark at that time. Rosie just got back from school, like March, the end of March. And when she came back, we were like, would go to friends if she came back on the weekend or whatever. And you would invite us. And I held off because I wanted Rosie and I to come together.
Yeah.
And see it for the first time, you know, together.
Right.
And I'm really glad we did do that. And as opposed to me just coming and then she coming. Pretty sure, and I had like deja vu because Bucky said it last sermon about BHAGs, big, hairy, audacious goals. And I think that was the first sermon that we heard when we came in April. I'm pretty sure Bucky was preaching. And we walk in and it was just different in a way that's, I don't know, you, I mean, we went to friends and this is not knocking friends. I think most churches are like this, but you know, they have their ushers and their people and you talk to people and you know, hey, turn around for a minute, say hi to people. And we went there for like 6 months or whatever. And again, I'm not knocking friends. Like I love Jay Hewitt's a pastor. He's great. And we liked it. And you know, I was set on going there. I was like, you know, this is the church for us. Right. And, but it's just like, if that was like a 99, the Watermark was like 110 or whatever. And, you know, like an example is like we, and I feel like people share this of like, you know, we walk in, people hand you flyers or whatever. And, but you never get to know those people. Or if you shake hands with someone, they're sitting in front of you. Like the next time you see them, it's not even like a hi. It's just like, yeah, I shook hands with that person one time or whatever. And it was just not the case here for whatever reason, and I like couldn't put my thumb on it for whatever, and I was like, are these people just like they never seen a new person in their life or something, or they're, maybe is it just like the same 100 people that come here and we were like the first newbies to like come in like a year or whatever, and they're like, oh my gosh. But it was, I we were sitting behind I can't even remember who it was honestly. But, you know, we turned around, say hi to people, and they were just, like, so happy to see us, and they were want to talk to us and want to know our whole life story and all this stuff. And I was like, yeah, we'll tell you. And I think, you know, we turned back around to our front. It was the same deal. And I was like, and the message from Bucky was amazing. And I left there like, whoa, that was, like, really crazy.
Yeah.
It was how you... you hear from those unique people that are like, I love my church. Like, I'm so involved in my church and this and that. And I never knew that of like, I always thought it was like, I don't know, one-off thing, or those people were just liars or something. And so, yeah, I was pretty much like, it was a done deal that we were going to come here forever.
Wow.
After that. And Rosie was like, hey, we'll give it another shot. You know, I don't think we should like totally just fall in love with it from day one.
Why, you guys are a good team.
And I was like, all right, I respect it. And then second time, same thing. And we were both like, yep, we love it. We're coming here. It's a done deal. And then you were speaking and I was like, dude, the Bert Bucky teed off and then Ben teed off and what do these guys have no limits? And then the third time I was like, again, it's this guy just teed off again, and the fourth time and the fifth time. And there was like one service where I was like and that was like a B plus. Every other time has been an A plus material where I just leave and I'm like, yes.
Oh my God.
That was great. And the people and all this stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm not trying to hype Watermark up for people that don't go here or whatever.
Hey, this is your story, man. You're just
this is literally just how it went. So yeah, we now we'll kind of get more into the business, I guess, of we're going to do the shop. Had to get this stupid permit that we took like 6 months to get. And we got that like back in September. And then since then, we really didn't even like start. That was like the pre-process. Right. Like people didn't even know. We didn't even like technically start until September. Right. So like we're kind of like, this is actually an okay timeline. We're like whatever, 6 months now. Like, yeah, that's usually the planning. And then you start building after 6 months. It's, building's like an 8 month kind of a deal.
Okay.
But still, it does feel like it's been a long time, but it's because of that super permit. I hadn't had any experience with that, and that was like a super difficult thing. Anyway, so yeah, all during this time, though, we have been formulating the brand, and I'm glad that we have had this time, to be honest, and I think we'll flash forward, you know, in a couple of years and be like, wow, we really were able to, you know, cock the slingshot back as far as we could have because we had this time.
That's cool. That's a good metaphor.
If we opened up, like, you know, as soon as we wanted, like, oh man, we wouldn't be here like at all. And, so yeah, the brand Lion and Lamb Coffee, I think just coming up with the name and deciding whether or not we're going to be a Christian brand was like a month long thing.
Right.
And that I totally was like, ah, I don't know, back and forth, like even having anxiety about that. And just like, I want to be a Christian man, but I don't. And truthfully, I think we would be setting ourselves up for better success if we were a Christian brand. Because Christians seem to rally behind their Christian brands.
Right.
But in formulating our brand and what we wanted to do, we did not want to be a Christian brand because I wanted to be open to everyone, but I want to set that example or whatever nature we have of just, you know, people come to our shop and they like us, you know, 6 months or whatever, a year down the road, people who might find Christians to be abhorrent or whatever. And they're like, oh, you guys are Christians? Like, that's weird. I don't know how I feel.
Just
about
remove
this.
The obstacle. Just remove the stumbling block. No barrier to entry.
Yeah.
Businesses already have enough barriers to entry. Let's just stick it out.
Yeah.
You want to reach people.
But I would like confuse people maybe to see our actions and then judge us for our labels, I guess. And maybe it can work that way. So, yeah. And even I think maybe sometime halfway through this last summer, we kind of made the choice to do 100% profits to charity, which I chose to do. I'm not sure. I mean, everyone is like, what is this? I don't get it. 100% profits to charity. And for sure, Rosie at the beginning and pretty much everyone. And I... So... To explain to you folks at home what it is, you know, we operate similarly to a nonprofit, which is, you know, nonprofits have overhead, you know, they have employees that they pay. It's the same as a business, really. It's just that, you know, they don't have a profit and they use all their money towards something. Either, you know, they buy more equipment for their nonprofit, you know. If it's a nonprofit food company, you know, they still have to buy stoves and stuff, and that's with money that people donate to them, and then they use, you know, other money for their cause, whatever that may be. So we're right in between a business, like a regular business, and a nonprofit. And so Rosie and I, we haven't exactly worked out everything that's going to happen, but usually how a business works is there's profit even after the owners pay themselves, you know, their salary, which can be large, or dividends or what have you. And then they choose like, hey, I'm going to take these and just put them in my bank account because I want the money, which is fine. I'm not knocking that. Capitalism's great. Or they can, you know, reinvest back into their business. So for us, we are technically called a social business, which is kind of like a newer entity, although it doesn't have any like legal standing with the government or the world, which is something that I also want to tackle because when you look at the problems we have in the world, it could be prevented for a number of reasons, but one of the reasons being is time and money. Nonprofits don't solve these problems because they don't have enough volunteers or whatever, mm-hmm. and most of the times they don't have enough money.
Right.
And if they did, problems would be solved a lot faster or what have you. And so I said, okay, so nonprofits need more money. What generates the most money? And that's a business. That's mm-hmm. what a business is, the only thing that generates money.
Right.
You know, wherever, way back in the day, exchanging goods for money or other goods, you know, that creates
social good,
currency.
Yeah.
And so, and it's that element of the profit that makes a unique and a self-sustaining thing of, we can do this forever.
Yeah.
And on a repeatable scale that can grow.
Yeah.
Versus a nonprofit, you're always asking for donations. You're always right. there. The, you know, higher ups are always going to functions and stuff to, you know, ask people for money, and it's their biggest bottleneck.
Mm-hmm.
And so you say, okay, well, why can't nonprofits sell things? Well, they can to some degree, but it's a gray area, and right. it's a gray area because
the government's
mm-hmm. one guy, you know, out there took advantage of the system and, you know, harbored a lot of money in a nonprofit or whatever. And now it's just like, oh, can't sell because people are going to take advantage of the system. And,
right.
and I get that, but it's also really sad because I really believe in what we're doing and that business can solve these problems through business relationships, but also generating money.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's really only one guy who in the last 30 or 20 years has spearheaded this, and there have been smaller companies outside of his network that do give back, but his name is Muhammad Yunus,
mm-hmm.
and he is a Nobel Prize winner in 2008 for his philanthropy and starting social businesses. He's the creator of microfinance, which was a big trend in like the 2010s mm-hmm. and stuff, microloans.
Yep.
And he's the guy who started probably hundreds of companies.
He founded basically the idea of microfinance, microlending.
Oh yeah. He started that in like the early 80s.
Wow.
And which is shocking to me to find out. He has 3 books, which I'll recommend at the end or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But so he started, the long story short is he's from Bangladesh.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very poor country and a very overpopulated country. It's
right.
The scale is like the entire population of the U.S. living in Florida is the scale of Bangladesh. So there's a lot of poverty and hard times there. And
right.
he was a university professor in the 80s, and there was a famine. And he would see all these poor people, and they would have loans with loan sharks because they couldn't get loans from the banks. And the loan sharks were charging them 100% interest or whatever that would just not leave them any room to grow. And so he went around to like 150 people and tallied up all their debt to these loan sharks, right? And it was $47 that these people were like chained to for like their life, you know, to a loan shark. And if they didn't take it back, then they were going to like lose their hut. You know, their mud hut with straw and like their one kerosene lantern or something.
Mm-hmm.
It's just ridiculous. So he set off on this quest, if you will. So he went to the bank, or he paid all those people the $47, and he said, okay, you can pay me back as you feel fit, or, you know, within 6 months or whatever, no interest or whatever.
Yeah, some basic terms.
Yeah. And so he's like, this has to change because, for obvious reasons. So he went to the bank and said, hey, can we help these people? They only need like $1 to, you know, get some materials to make some baskets or whatever so they can sell at the market. And they're like, oh no, they're too poor. They have no credit, this and that. And so that was like a dead end. So he's like, okay, I'll co-sign the loan for like a couple hundred people. And it was like not much money again. And they all repaid like all of them, like 100%.
Yeah.
And he was like, okay, can you see like poor people can do it, you know, to the bank? Do you, so I don't need to co-sign anymore. They're like, no, it's not going to work. So long story short, it was like a long process, but he eventually starts a bank called Grameen Bank. And Grameen Bank is what is a nonprofit, and he founded it, and that's what helped him win the Nobel Prize. And I forget the number exactly, but it's like an astronomical number of the amount of money. It's hundreds of millions a month that they loan out to people all over the world, not just Bangladesh, but it started in Bangladesh. And the repayment rate is like 98% or something. Hmm. And the bank is owned by the borrowers. And I don't have all the, you know, facts behind it. I read the book.
People can get it.
Yeah. It's just like a really cool model. And something that you would never think would work, you know. And there's one in America. There's like three or four. And it's, I think they've loaned out $1 billion in America in a couple of years.
Yeah. Can I jump in there?
Yeah.
So special man, special ministry, whether he's a believer or not, incredible special ministry.
He's a Muslim.
That's okay. Yeah. Muslim guy. He's affecting lives in a tangible way, creating life. He's creating life, through his vision, his philosophy of social business, even if the bank is a nonprofit. Something I learned from you just sitting there, you know, as we were talking about this at lunch last week, that is a key staple of the Lion and the Lamb. And you said this phrase that really, as I just even listen to you now and I'm learning and my ears are open about profit versus nonprofit, and profit is that key.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do with it? It's all, that's the crux of the issue. Do you inject it back into the business? Do you, again, for your personal account, savings, investment, wherever it goes, right? And your vision is after you've paid operations and facilities and payroll, 100% of profits goes to these causes. Which is, and the dollar lives forever. That was the phrase you said the other day. The dollar lives on, or the dollar lives forever.
Yeah, so there's a
beautiful picture.
There's two aspects to a social business, and there can be, it's kind of a loose definition, but really the two main things are, in your business, you, as a social business, as a business, you are supporting, you're able to support other businesses, right? So the example that I have is, you know, we set the bar of, you know, we're going to leave the world a better place and we're going to be eco-friendly in this. So when it came time to decide what our coffee was going to be, there was no choice. Our coffee had to be organic.
Mm-hmm.
Our coffee had to be fair trade.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas most businesses would be like, I'm not going to buy organic and fair trade because it's just more money. Mm-hmm. The consumer doesn't really care.
Right.
But we had to. And through that chain, so since we buy organic and we buy fair trade, it's a cycle that can continue forever. And because, so the example is we team up with a nonprofit called the Kula Project, which started out as a nonprofit to help women farmers get better business practices and become better entrepreneurs. And they teach them and they supply them with capital to grow their business and stuff like that. So things started in like 2010. And the majority of the people they help are women who are coffee farmers. And the fact that it was coffee didn't really matter in the early stages, but now they're just starting to harvest the green beans that you roast.
Right.
And so I was approached by the founder in kind of a unique, odd way. But we, you know, got to talking and I really love her brand. So they sell the green coffee. That nonprofit, Kula Project, buys the coffee from these women farmers at fair trade price, which is a great price to begin with.
Right.
Then they turn around, they act as the middleman, and then sell it to people like me for me to roast.
Yeah.
Then they take that profit from selling it to me and re-inject it into their nonprofit, Kula, to help more women farmers.
Right.
And then we roast those beans, turn it into more profit. And so we're able to be on this endless loop, right, of we're buying product from Kula, they're getting profit, they're expanding their cause. And so are we, and we're able to grow.
Yeah.
And we can recreate that again and again with other businesses, whether it be, you know, our our milk or our chocolate or our t-shirts mm-hmm. or our mugs right. and support so other businesses.
That's beautiful. So that's is that point one or is that point one and two of what makes a social business?
That's point one.
Okay, that's point one. Give me point two and then we're coming to the top of the hour. We may have to do a part two on this episode.
Part two.
Yeah.
Cool. It's coming. So you want part two now?
No, part two of the what you said social.
Oh, right. Yeah. So that's one part is the ability for a business, and that's where the profit comes in is these cycles, right? Versus a nonprofit is, you know, if they get a dollar, someone donates to them, that dollar is going to be used and it's going to be gone because it either it buys somebody a meal or it buys something and you're not able to reinvest that dollar. Mm-hmm. Although those things are important, which is why we do donate money to those very causes because mm-hmm. there are people on the brink of death that need food.
Human needs right now.
Yeah. But there's the other aspect that I think is not being worked on, which is this aspect of sustainability and being able to maybe prevent those problems in the first place. Mm-hmm. And that the only way is through something that can sustain itself through business. And so it's both those things. And so we're able to do that. We're going to have profits and we're going to give those to immediate causes like food and hunger and or thirst and homelessness and all this stuff. And those are great, but also having relationships, sustainable relationships, organic and fair trade and teaming up with people that also have like-minded business practices that are giving back.
Right.
And that can go on forever.
Right.
So, yeah.
That's beautiful. And you answered the second part of my question, which is what are some of those partners or businesses or nonprofits you care to invest in? And we may not have all the names now. We won't talk about that today, but those are the causes. Whether you have the exact brands, the exact companies, mm-hmm. those will come. Man, I just got to thank you. This was incredible. Just sitting here listening to you. Could have gone on for a long time, and maybe we will get it going on a part two. There's all kinds of details we'll release to people about when we're breaking ground, what's coming next for Lion and Lamb. People get a chance to meet you and Rosie on a Sunday coming up here pretty soon.
Oh.
I'm excited for all that. But for now, man, thank you so much for just pouring your heart out here. It's beautiful. It makes me feel awesome and gives me amazing resolve and faith and joy for this relationship that God has really sovereignly conducted. That's one of the biggest takeaways from listening to your story. And I know people listening will get that. He was a conductor like every step of the way.
Yeah. Well, if we have to have a part two because the crescendo is coming like in part two, which totally relates back to like the shop and Watermark and all that. So, and we're pretty much there. So
good. Okay. Yeah. We'll do it. We'll pick it up. It's worthwhile. So we'll jump into that next time. Thanks you guys for listening, rating, reviewing, sending this show to someone who needs to hear it. There's a lot there from his amazing season of crippling, health issues to business and what he learned all the way into social enterprise. Such amazing takeaways. So send it to someone who needs to hear it and they can be encouraged by it. For now, thanks for listening and we will catch you next week.
See ya.